The Illinois Department of Children and Family Services says it desperately needs foster parents to care for LGBT youth, and it's appealing to the LGBT community for help.
The bottom line on fostering LGBT kids or kids in general, you know, as a gay couple, you just got to jump in with both feet and allow your instincts to kick in. You know, we all have the inherent ability to parent.
Also,
genes are important in how they interact with your environment, from your diet to your physical activity, a variety of things that we now have the ability to measure. A few years back, we probably couldn't do quite as well.
This is Dr. John Flack with Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. We talked to him about this new approach to medicine and how you can help, and how social media and one intrepid woman helped a Belvedere resident find her dog after he had been lost for 42 days. All that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome to the 21st. The Illinois Department of Children and Family Services is making an appeal, especially to the LGBT community, to help with fostering LGBT youth and to all current and prospective foster parents to make them aware of the challenges these young people are facing in the current foster and adoption system. The need is so great that the department has used the term desperate to describe this situation. They've held seminars most recently in Chicago to reach out to the community to ask them for help. Joining us now to talk about this is Juliana Harms. She's the Associate Deputy Director in Behavioral Health at the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services. Julia, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
I wonder how you would characterize the situation right now within the foster care system and the need, particularly for foster families for LGBT youth.
Well, most definitely, we have the call to build resources for our children who are entering the child welfare system. So there is an immense need for foster caregivers for all of our children. But we find that there are some special challenges with work to foster our LGBT youth. I think because there are some myths, some challenges, some misunderstandings, and a lot of education might be needed to support individuals who are embarking upon this journey of fostering so that they know that our LGBT youth are just like any other youth who require a safe family home.
And when you say there's some education that needs to be done, Illinois was actually the first in the country. DCFS back in 2009 had a specific policy crafted specifically for the foster care system and LGBT youth. What do you think, what are the challenges and myths that need to be overcome when we're talking about these children?
Well, and thank you so much for the recognition of the policy. It's something about which we have great pride, because we recognize that the youth that we serve, our LGBT youth, needed the extra support, not because there is a pathology or there is something that is wrong, but because the majority or the heteronormative larger world sometimes does not have the most positive response to an individual who's expressing sexual orientation or a gender identity that might be different than the biology with which they were born. So that can be an intimidating piece of information for individuals to absorb. So, of course, we know that education goes a long way to dispel myths or presumptions about who a person is or what a person needs. And that was the intent behind the policy, as well as the creation of a position for an LGBTQI coordinator to help provide that assistance for the education and creating resources for our gay and lesbian youth.
Do you find that it's hard that there are that placement or that there are issues with placement or a family saying if a foster child comes out or has other sexuality questions or identity issues? Is that a common problem in the foster care system where maybe a family isn't comfortable with that and says, we don't think we want this child in our home?
I think that it can pose a challenge because, again, people sometimes are intimidated or not fully understanding what this means. The coming out process is something that is very fluid for a child, a young adult, an adolescent. As I said, it's fluid. There can be changing ideologies, changing self-views. So we sometimes run into a number of circumstances that can be challenging. One is a youth may be out in the system, clearly expressing or exploring identity, and caregivers may not feel comfortable fostering in that circumstance, again, because they don't really know what the youth's needs are or may have a misapprehension of what it means to be gay. And then the second challenge, which sometimes is quite heartbreaking, is if a youth who has been searching for identity, looking at him or herself to determine, you know, who am I, and decides to express orientation or trans status, and the caregiver says, I don't think I'm in a position to continue to foster. And there's already been a relationship that's been established. So we work with those circumstances on a case-by-case basis, again, to offer supports, to try to demystify what is happening in the youth's lives and how these caregivers can support the children who so very much need a home, need a family setting.
Juliana, I know that the numbers say that there are 25,000 homeless youth in Illinois. 40% of those young people identify as LGBT. And oftentimes we've all heard stories of children or young people who have been asked to leave their house when they've come out or face difficult family situations and have left, either voluntarily or not. Do those young people find their way into the foster care system?
Some do. Some sadly remain on the streets with limited resources. And we recognize that this is a situation that involves not only families of origin or extended family members, but also they run into roadblocks through community or lack of community services, how they are treated in an educational environment. There can be bullying, there can be isolation, obviously a less than welcoming circumstance at times. So there are multiple systems affecting the life domains of these youths, which then sadly leads them to a homeless status. And sometimes our youth are trying to establish their own family, but they're not finding that their home of origin is supportive. So there are multiple factors that do come into play. Some youth do enter the child welfare system, but again, there is such a limitation with regard to supports and what's available and even the education that can be provided to the children themselves to say, hey, this is the resource that we have in this area for you. Because again, this is something that occurs throughout the state, not just in larger urban areas.
I know that last month, DCFS held a recruitment seminar at the University of Illinois in Chicago to provide information for becoming foster and adoptive parents, and it was specifically looking within Chicago's LGBT community. Why did you guys decide to reach out specifically? What was behind that effort?
Well, we recognize that this is an untapped wealth of support for all children who are in foster care or maybe entering foster care. And I think that, the recognition that many times the LGBT adult community is also marginalized or fragmented from some of the opportunities that are afforded to the heteronormative group, we wanted to make sure that we were inclusive and tapped into our LGBT community. Because again, a wealth of support, individuals who are there, who have solid, safe, caring homes, we wanted to bring them into the mix of fostering, because again, this hadn't really fully been explored. I mean, there had been efforts in certain areas, but we wanted to make sure that there was a broad reach to tap into this community of strong individuals.
We've been speaking with Juliana Harms. She's with the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, where she's an Associate Deputy Director of Behavioral Health. She was just telling us about this seminar at UIC. I want to bring someone else into the conversation who was actually a guest at that seminar, and that's foster parent Mark Wilson. He and his husband are foster parents of four sons that range in age from 16 months to 30 years old. They've also fostered others on a short-term basis, and he's joining us now from Chicago. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Good morning. What did you say as a foster parent at that seminar?
You know, that seminar was, a really good opportunity for me to share the stories of my two older boys, both who identify as gay. And the older one came to us when he was older. But when we met him, he had been literally passed around from one relative to the next relative until he was 18 and then kicked out of his home. And then he went from a boyfriend to a boyfriend to a boyfriend, predator situations where he was literally abused physically, financially. Mm. And when he moved into our home, he had full-blown AIDS. He was 85 pounds and did not have the skills or the resources to take care of himself because he had never been mentored and nurtured.
And how old was he when he moved into your house?
He was actually in his early 20s already.
Okay. And how did you guys meet? So this
we
sounds
met
like
at a block party actually.
Okay. So informally, obviously, kind
yeah,
of a
we met him informally at a block party and he at the time was living with somebody who was abusing him and used his social security number to take out payday loans and was abusing him physically. And it boiled down to a really, really rough night. And he called me and said, "Hey, my boyfriend had a guy here that was using heroin and was trying to kill me all night." And I said, "Okay, we'll be outside of your house in 5 minutes. I'll be right there." So we kind of, we assessed the situation, and he needed access to services that he didn't know how to find, and we helped him with that. And then that led to coming to the attention of a couple caseworkers in our area who were working with a 15-year-old boy who had just come out, and they were looking for a home for him, and they kind of approached us and asked if we would be willing to help, and that's when we became licensed as foster parents. But what I talked about in the seminar was the difference in the development of these two boys. When the 15-year-old moved in, he was out of the closet already. He had, the foster home he had been in previous to ours was okay with him being gay, and he didn't have the trauma of being gay as a part of his narrative. He definitely had, things he was working through as a child who was a ward of the state, but being gay wasn't a big deal. The older one, he had lived a very significant trauma history because of that fact of his life, because of who he was. And so the contrast in the success and development of each of these boys, when you compare them, is just night and day. And it really drove home the need for having homes for these kids to be able to explore that and express that and develop themselves normally, without that being a trauma piece.
And over you and your husband, how many children have you all fostered over the years?
I've never counted. the four that we kind of count as our core kids, obviously they're the long-term ones. But we've had a couple teenagers in there, straight. We haven't had any other gay kids. We've been approached for a couple different ones, and depending on, what the situation is in our home, we always assess that based on the case-by-case basis. Probably, in addition to the four, probably seven or eight.
And Juliana, I wonder if you can sort of share the response of how that seminar went, and as people like Mark and his husband shared their story of being foster parents. Are you all seeing success in connecting with the community, with specifically within the LGBT community, in terms of trying to find more folks who will be willing to be in the foster system formally?
We are seeing a positive response, and the willingness for individuals to open their homes is absolutely gratifying. But again, the positive response has been marvelous, and we think that this effort was something that we would like to repeat. We'd like to share the word that we definitely need the resource, and again, tap into a very strong community.
Mark, I wonder, you and your husband, you mentioned your two older boys. Now you have two younger sons. I wonder what you want to share about that experience in terms of how different it is to parent, to start with a 15-year-old foster, because you were talking as sort of the difference between 20s and 15, but now you have a 7-year-old and a 16-month-old.
Yes. You know, the younger ones, you know, we had an overlap with when the second son went to college. We had an overlap of one day when a 4-year-old came into our home, and you know, it's an entirely different experience. You know, you're dealing with kids who kids who know how to tie their shoes and kids who don't. It's an entirely different experience. You know, going with the older ones and the younger ones. We love it both of them. Both of the experiences are eye-opening, and you grow from it every day.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation for just a few more minutes with Mark Wilson, who's a foster parent within the Department of Children and Family Services system, as long as Julia Harms from DCFS, continuing this conversation, particularly around LGBT youth and the foster system. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st and tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about LGBT youth in Illinois, particularly in regards to the foster care system. Illinois was actually the first state in the nation to create a specific policy within DCFS and the foster care system for LGBT youth. My guest is Juliana Harms. She's the Associate Deputy Director in Behavioral Health at the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services. We've also been speaking with longtime foster parent Mark Wilson, who's on the line with us from Chicago, about his 4 sons and all of the other children that he and his husband have been foster parents to over the years. Juliana, you know, we've been using the term LGBT with a broad brush. I wanted to just ask you specifically about trans youth, because I imagine that there are specific issues that trans youth are facing that may be different from other from lesbian, gay, or bisexual youth who identify with their birth gender. And that may be a difficult thing within the foster system also to deal with.
It is. And we have seen more and more trans youth coming out. It's almost yet another coming out process within the larger community. And there are some specific health needs, because, of course, there is that discord between biology, the physical being of the person who identifies as trans, and then how that person identifies overall. And there are many questions that our youth have. There's sometimes a little bit of knowledge that can spur additional questions. Commonly, youth have questions about hormones, about how they can work to change their body to match how they actually feel they are. So there are some specific supports that are needed. We recognize that hormones are not the answer for everybody, but certainly, again, that understanding of how to meld the self view with the biology, with who that person is globally, can take a lot of support and a number of steps and again, support from the community to do that.
Mark, your second son, did your second son specifically request to be placed with a same-sex couple? Is that correct?
He did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Juliana, is that a common thing is there a certain age where children can express that within the foster care system? How does that work?
Absolutely. That's part of the matching process, and that is feedback that is important when we do that linkage between a caregiver and a child. And certainly, you know, we recognize that a lot of children are expressing who they are younger and younger. So it may not necessarily be, say, a cutoff. We'd say a 13-year-old would have the right to say, this is the living environment I desire. We speak to the children and ask, where do you feel comfortable? Where do you feel safe? Some children are saying, yes, I want to be with somebody who identifies as I identify or knows what I'm going through. Other children say, you know, I just want a family who will protect me, will support me, et cetera. And sometimes kids just don't know. So there does have to be discussion around that, and there has to be somebody willing to listen.
Mark, it's interesting to hear your story as you all started informally fostering and then into the formal foster care system with teenagers and now with younger children. Do you think how important is it for the larger LGBT community to be involved in parenting, not just of LGBT, specifically LGBT youth?
You know, I think it's important for a lot of people to be involved, whether they're LGBT or not. As far as the LGBT community is concerned, I think there's so much life experience that people of my generation experienced that through helping these younger folk can help those folk avoid the trauma of growing up and the fear of being different, the fear of having people find out about, you know, this deep, dark secret. You know, when you grow up in that situation, you develop defensive strategies that can often lead to behavior issues and just a simple fear. You know, being able to offer space and a loving home for somebody to not experience that can help shape them and build on their strengths instead of having them hide them.
Juliana, for people who are listening to this, what are steps for someone if they're interested in people who are interested in taking part in the foster care system and taking part in perhaps fostering a child?
The best first step would be to contact the local DCFS office. That way, information can be shared about education and the licensing process. And I think it's probably most convenient for individuals. Again, they connect with an office that is close to where they live, and that can start the process rolling.
Thanks for that, and thanks for taking the time to speak with us about that. We'll have all of those resources. We'll tweet them out if you follow 21st Show. We'll have them up on our website at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Juliana Harms from the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services and Mark Wilson, a foster parent, joining us from Chicago. Thanks for being with me, guys.
You're welcome.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. What would you do if your dog went missing for more than a month? If you're a pet owner, that's something you hope you're never faced with. But Belvedere resident Billy Sparacino was. Fortunately, her story has a happy ending. After 42 days of being lost, Billy was reunited with her dog, Tank. It took lots of help on social media and a Belvedere stranger, Stephanie Hicks, who spent weeks looking for Tank and was instrumental in getting him back. Both of them join us on the phone now. Billy, Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Billy, I think the first question that everybody always wants to know when a dog gets lost is, how did Tank get away?
You know, Tank's always been an escape artist. We've had him for 9 years since he was a baby, and he can go over, under, through. He always figures out a way to get out, and he hates being outside, so he would get out and go to the front door. And that night, we were at a graduation party. My husband came home early, put the kids to bed, let the dog out, went back to let him in, and he was not there. Went to the front door, and he was not there, and he was just vanished.
Oh, no. And where did you go from there? What did you do next?
He had actually done this a year ago, first time ever, eight years old, he did this. And he was at the neighbor's house. They were shooting off fireworks, and he actually went to them probably out of curiosity, and they just kept him overnight. So when this happened, I naturally thought he was at the neighbor's, and he wasn't. And I started combing the neighborhood. I was out till 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was no sign of him. So the next day, I put him on our local buy-sell trade, just asking if anyone sees him to please let me know.
Stephanie, at what point did you get involved and try to help?
At the time, I was volunteering through a local humane society, and I had seen a share of Tanks missing, and Billy had called in and said that he was missing, and then I made contact with her from there. And how that started.
And Billy, people started posting pictures, right? The social media really helped in you kind of tracking down where Tank was, because during this 42-day period, how often were you get sightings of people saying, hey, I saw this dog?
It started off like one after another. Every day was a sighting. The first sighting, we live on across from Highway 90, and it's a 6-lane highway. And the very first sighting was on the other side of that highway.
Oh, boy.
And so somehow he had gotten across there. And from there, it was across another 4-lane highway to a subdivision. But I was getting sightings at first every day, several sightings. And then they started spreading out more every 3 days. Then it was 5 days. And the last sighting before I got him home was 3 weeks prior to when we actually got him back. But every one of them was a complete stranger that had seen it on social media and said, hey, I see your dog. And you know, was trying to help us get him back. So he was shared, his face was shared 1,300 times on social media to get him home.
Wow. And Stephanie, you found a couple of lost dogs. And one of the strategies you used was you set out traps with food trails leading to them. Did that work with Tank?
It did not work with Tank. The first thing that really needs to be done that Billy did excellent with is sharing on social media and flyering the area to get the sightings. You really have to kind of have an idea of a given area where they've maybe stopped and have feel comfortable with there's a water source there to be able to set up a trap for it to be effective. And Tank sightings were miles apart from each other, and we did attempt to set up cameras and traps, but unfortunately he was making such large moves, it was really hard to use that means with them.
And Billy, how did he finally get found?
Well, one of the sightings was on a road called Shattuck Road, and right on that curve was a home, and Stephanie noticed that behind there was a creek, and she said, well, he's got to go to food and water, so maybe we should check there and see if she had seen him. And the lady had not, but she had had a chicken killed recently, and it was left in an odd place. It was just a very odd setup, so Stephanie thought, you know, I think we should trap here and set up food here. And so we did that for a week, and I got nothing but a raccoon and close to one skunk on camera and in the trap.
No.
I got nothing there. And I had left my clothes there so that our scent was there. I had brought my other dog there so that he would have a familiar scent, hopefully, to bring him there. And we got absolutely nothing. And then after 3 weeks, we had a storm the night before. And the day that we got him, we had a really bad storm with a lot of lightning and thunder. And the lady that had allowed us to set a trap called, she said, you know, you set traps at our house, and I said yes. And she said, you know, I think I have your dog. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, everything matches. Everything you told me matches. The face matches. The size matches. She's like, I really think I have your dog. And I said, well, do you have him in sight, or do you have him in your hands? Because up to this point, if someone even rolled down their window, he would take off running, and he would go for miles to a completely new location. So, you know, that was my biggest thing is, well, do you see him or do you have him? She said, honey, he's sitting right next to me on my porch.
Oh, and then what was your reaction?
Oh, it was, you know, I got to be honest, after 42 days, you have to somewhat put in your mind that he's probably dead. The last sighting, he was limping pretty bad. He was not moving very fast. We have a lot of wildlife, a lot of coyotes, a lot of things like that around us that he would have easily fallen prey to. So I have to be honest, in my heart, I was to the point that I really was beginning to think he was dead. And when I saw his face, it was like seeing something come back from the dead. It was still the most unbelievable sight after that long. It was, of course, a crying fest and an unbelievable, he's actually here, you know.
We're speaking with Billy Sparacino about her dog, Tank, that got lost in Belvedere. And through the good work of Stephanie and sounds like lots of people on social media, she found him. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Dr. Dave Bidal is an associate veterinarian at All Pets Veterinary Hospital in Peoria. Dr. Bidal, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I think people who are listening to this who have pets are thinking, have I done everything I can do to prevent being in this situation if my pet gets lost? What do you suggest that people do?
The best thing that an owner can do is have their animal microchipped. A microchip is a little electronic chip that sits in a little glass cylinder. It's about the grain of rice, the size of a grain of rice, and that is injected underneath their skin, and then that chip number that they have is actually registered in a database. But if an animal is lost, they can and is scanned by either a shelter or a vet clinic, the number comes up and it can be put into the database and matched with the owner. And that's probably one of the top ways to be prepared for something like that.
So just to be clear, that's not GPS. It doesn't tell you where the dog is, but if the dog gets found, it tells you who the dog's or whatever animal, because it doesn't, just not just dogs that can be microchipped, right?
Correct. Yeah. There's no GPS, anything to do with that. It's literally just the number on a chip.
Dr. Bidal, if someone finds a lost dog, is it a good idea to try to get them to come to you? How do you kind of assess the situation?
My thoughts, and you're going to get varying thoughts among varying veterinarians and shelter workers and things, but if the dog is really friendly or like, sometimes puppies get out and they just want to play, that's fine. But if the dog makes any funny moves or it does not appear friendly or is trying to run away, just call it in to either usually to animal control or the local shelter. Here in Peoria, we have animal control and the main shelter are kind of connected, and that's the best place to call because that's the most common place for people who have lost a dog to call in their lost dog. So they're the ones that kind of coordinate that. So it's not, you don't run after and chase after them, because even as the folks before me here talking about the dog, a lot of them will take off and run.
Yeah. Stephanie, you used to volunteer with the PAWS organization in Rockford. What would you do if someone brought in a lost pet?
I will second what he just said, that you want to contact the local vet or the animal control office and have it scanned, have the dog scanned for the microchip.
Billy, what does it mean to you to have Tank home again after more than a month? As you said, you weren't sure where he was or even if he was still alive.
You know, I think this has been one of the most humbling journeys I've ever been on. I just want to say, for the record, my dog was not chipped, and I thought he was. So if anyone has an older dog, I encourage them to go and make sure they're chipped, because my dog, when he was neutered, I really thought I had a chip put in him then. And I had another dog neutered at the same time, the same day. And when I couldn't find my paperwork, I took my other dog up, and they said, he's not chipped. And that sent me into a more panic, because now if he moves across counties, how is he ever going to get home? So I had no idea. And they told me, back 9 years ago, the vets didn't push it as much. It was really expensive. The price has gone way down. And now veterinarians really push to have them chipped. But if you have an older dog, my dog has never left home. And then we went on this 42-day journey. So I would just really encourage anyone to get their dog chipped that hasn't. But it was a big community got him home. I Stephanie and I will be friends for life, and Nancy, the woman that found him. I mean, I've made terrific friends. The Belvedere Police Department even brought their tracking dog out to try and track him to make sure it was him that was at the sighting, and things. I mean, it was a very big community event, and it really gave me hope for our community. We have so much negativity in the news and in the media, and I can't tell you the outpouring of help and support from community members and complete strangers that helped me get that dog home.
Oh, well, thanks for sharing your story. Thanks to Billy Sparacino and to Stephanie Hicks for coming on and sharing that. Dr. Bidal, for giving us that veterinary advice. We should point out that National Chipping Check Your Chip Day is actually right around the corner on August 15th, to echo what Billy said. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Most medical treatments are designed for the average person, but it turns out that a person's genes, environment, lifestyle all play a role in disease, so that personalizing treatments can go a long way to making people healthier. This personalized approach to health and wellness is called precision medicine, and it's a direction that the medical field is headed more towards these days. To help us understand more, we wanted to talk about two specific efforts that are happening here in Illinois, and we're joined by two researchers from Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. Wiley Jenkins is an associate professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine, and Dr. John Flack is a professor and chair in the Department of Internal Medicine. And both of us are on the line with us now. Welcome to the 21st, Professor Jenkins, Dr. Flack.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Professor Jenkins, the SIU School of Medicine recently joined a White House-led initiative that's called the National Precision Medicine Initiative. What's that all about?
Well, this is an initiative put on by the White House to really drive forward our understanding of some of the complex and yet subtle factors that influence health and disease in people. And so ultimately what they hope to do is recruit more than 1 million individuals across the United States, link them by their electronic health records, collect data on their health behaviors, on their use of medical care, on their family history, on their genes, on exposures they may have, and then from the analysis of this tremendous amount of data, have a better means of teasing out what are the stronger influences for health and disease, and also what may be more applicable to an individual versus the average patient.
Dr. Flack, can you give us a specific example of how this might work, what Professor Jenkins is talking about? How can precision medicine be beneficial, I guess, when we're talking about specific diseases in particular?
Well, it can range from a variety of things can be influenced by it. So, for example, if we look at a group of people who get a drug, a blood pressure lowering drug like an ACE inhibitor or calcium blocker or any class of drug, and we look at a response for that person or that person aggregated in a group such as white patients, black patients, et cetera, we come out with an average response. And so in clinical medicine, what has happened but erroneously happened is that if a black patient is being considered for use of an ACE inhibitor and a large number of white patients have had a greater response to their drug than black patients, people will say, physicians will say, well, these drugs don't work very well in blacks. The problem with that is that there are many blacks who respond better than whites, and whites who respond obviously less well than blacks, despite the fact that the overall average is more favorable in the white population. And if you look at the blood pressure responses, they're widely variable in blacks and whites. So what precision medicine is going to allow us to do is, instead of taking group responses and then extrapolating them back to each individual in that group, we're going to be able to really ignore group membership and say, look, if you have this set of risk factors, these genes, and this environment, and you get a drug like an ACE inhibitor or a calcium blocker, what is your response likely to be? And so we're putting people in more refined groups where there's less variation in response, and you can only do that with large numbers and a very detailed database. That allows me to treat any patient, irrespective of their group label, as an individual, not as the lighthouse of being the average response for that entire group, which is widely variable.
Professor Jenkins, Dr. Flack is talking about a database. I know you're hoping to get 1 million people from all over the U.S. involved in a new study. Can you tell us more about what you all are looking for?
Well, there are a lot of things we know that influence health and disease, and some are fairly obvious. Smoking obviously has a negative impact. Exercise is well known to have a positive impact. And we also know that there is a heritable basis to many diseases. There are multiple cancers where there is a strong genetic component that we know about. There are also many other chronic conditions for which there is a strong genetic component. And there are also diseases that are associated with certain types of environmental exposure, such as asbestos, for example, or working in a battery factory where you're exposed to lead. But what's not really known is sometimes lesser-known exposures or exposures that are not as obvious, or multiple combinations of genes and how the combination of four or five different gene mutations may influence health or disease. And these types of studies, to understand what truly is significant, require tremendous numbers of samples. For example, when they are looking at trying to find some of the genetic determinants of some types of lung cancer, they will do full genome sequencing of over 3,000 specimens, just with the hope of trying to tease out a few of these genetic influences. And so what we're looking at is to gather enough data on enough people that we can actually make strong associations between multiple genetic components, multiple environmental exposures, for things that are not obvious, like smoking or exercise.
I see. And Professor Jenkins, are you specifically, how many people are you all specifically hoping to look at within Illinois?
In the state of Illinois, our goal is a minimum of 150,000 patients over the next approximately 4.5 years.
Okay. And who specifically, as you said, it looks like you guys are just looking for a lot of diversity among subjects, right?
That is absolutely correct. This study is based on a similar study called the Framingham Heart Study, which began, I believe, in 1948, where they enrolled about 5,000 patients in New England. And they're still doing that study. Over 70 years, they're still following these individuals. The weakness of that design is it really applies only to white people who live in New England. And so by recruiting across the entire United States, by purposely recruiting underserved populations, minority populations, we hope to get a data set that is much more representative of the United States as a whole. And then we can then also tease down to look specifically at certain racial, ethnic, or cultural groups within that whole. So it gives us a much greater ability to understand disease across the United States as a whole, but also specific to certain populations which may not have been studied well before.
And so as you're thinking about building a database, building sort of this diversity of people, it sounds like you're looking for people to study long-term. What kind of information will they need to provide for you guys?
Well, they need to give us questionnaire data about their diet, their habits, things like alcohol intake, exercise, and basic measurements like blood pressure, height, weight. And also, we asked them to give us blood, urine, and DNA specimens so we can use those to better characterize them, their genetic makeup, as well as some of the levels of factors we can measure in blood and urine.
Mm-hmm. And how important is it, Dr. Flack, for you all to have folks who are from, as we're talking about ethnic diversity, how important is it also in terms of geographic diversity to have people from rural versus urban areas?
Well, that was actually one of the main strengths of our application, is that we had a heavy rural component based in Chicago with multiple universities, but we also had a very tightly linked downstate component that we're coordinating here at Southern Illinois, which is going to have people from rural areas as well as smaller town USA. And the people at the NIH who were responsible for evaluating these applications and all actually gave the feedback to the leaders of the grant that one of the absolute strong suits of this application was its geographic diversity. Its ability to pull universities together, which typically don't work together, to also bring in access to patient populations that span some of the largest city, one of the largest cities in the world, to smaller areas, and that was a huge plus.
Professor Jenkins, I wonder if you could, as we're thinking about this, the study, obviously this is sort of a long-term thing, so I just wonder what the timeline is for developing this database, how long you all think you'll will be doing research, and when you think that'll be applicable to helping maybe even diseases for which there aren't treatments yet.
The NIH is taking a very long-term approach with this, and this initial funding cycle is for 5 years, and technically there is no research component associated with this particular grant. This is for the express purpose of recruiting individuals. Now, in the next couple of years, there will be other funding opportunities and grants put out by the NIH to actually study the data and start looking for these associations. But we need to remember that the 1 million or more individuals is an aspirational goal that will not be reached probably for at least another 4 or 5 years or longer. And so some of this deep data analysis that we're hoping to be able to do is realistically at least 4 or 5 years away. Now, we may be able to get some preliminary data on some types of diseases before then. Once we get 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 people, that is still a tremendous amount of data. But the data analysis, especially when you look at things like specimen analysis, we're looking probably realistically 5, 10, 15 years down the road. But there's every indication that once this study begins and once these individuals are enrolled and are participating, that this will continue for essentially the indefinite future. Of course, as the NIH always puts out the caveat, so long as funding continues to be available, this study will continue. But I think it will very quickly show its worth, both in the new scientific data, but also, as Dr. Flack alluded to, the idea of developing much more precision-based treatments for individuals versus the average patient. That may occur, again, within as soon as 5 to 10 years. Again, a lot of the more complex things probably later.
That's Professor Wiley Jenkins with Southern Illinois University School of Medicine, joined by his colleague, Dr. John Flack, talking to us about some new research they're going to be doing into precision medicine. If you're interested in more of this, we're going to have more information about this up at our website. We'll tweet the link out as well if you follow 21st Show. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
A few weeks ago, we talked with Brent Ressler of the Small World Connections organization in Chillicothe, Illinois. Brent and his ministry group were attempting to set a Guinness World Record for the longest line of pencils ever made. We wanted to give you an update on that. Brent, welcome back to the 21st. You have to just answer the question we all want to know, which is, did you guys set the world record?
Yes, we did. It was fun. We had a great turnout, and we ended up getting line total was 2,216 pencils, which took us a little over 3 hours to get that assembled, but laid them out on the ground, and none of them blew away or rolled away, and everything stayed put, so we're able to apply for the final process with Guinness now.
So 2,216 pencils all lined up, it all worked out.
Yeah, and it the measurement was quite a ways, actually, about a quarter mile long is how long the line was. It's about 400 meters long, so that's quite a bit, and we had to wrap it around a room where we were doing it at Three Sisters Park, and it was just a fun day, and it all worked out. We had great volunteers that helped out with it, and people were able to contribute at the end and get involved with laying out some of the pencils that came to the event, and it just ended up being a really fun day.
Yeah, and you also did this as a fundraiser, not just for your organization, but lots of other nonprofits in the area. Was that a success in terms of how much fundraising you all were able to do? It was for a wide variety of different organizations, right?
Yeah, it was. It really, one of the big pluses was the awareness. I mean, it gave us a chance for these different groups to have exposure to people that maybe wouldn't come to a fundraiser for their event, And so with 11 different groups, we were able to find out about, certain organizations we might never find out about otherwise. So it was really good exposure in that way. We had, we were fighting the weather. It was a little bit of a hot day, so we didn't have quite as good a turnout as we wanted, but on the record side of things, everything went great, and we were able to just have a great event. And, everything went well.
And so now you're going through the process of where you have to be officially accepted by the Guinness Book of World Records. How long does that take?
Well, it takes up to 12 weeks. In fact, I was just doing that before we started talking, submitting all the paperwork. We had to get the witnesses to verify. We had official witnesses and a surveyor measure the line, and everybody has a form to fill out, and Guinness is very detailed about the expectations and all the criteria. So it looks like we have everything that they asked for. So I'm getting ready, hopefully by the end of today or tomorrow, submitting all the paperwork. And then we find out in about 12 weeks if we officially met all their requirements.
And what are you going to do with all these pencils, Brent? You have, because you all collected how many, 6,000 pencils, and you only ended up using
like
7,000 pencils?
More like 7,000, yeah, because people brought them to the event too. I didn't count on so many people bringing them to the event. So we ended up with about 7,000. We've already sent about 2,000 to an orphanage in Haiti. A group was going down there on a mission trip, so we sent that with them, and it'll go to the kids to be able to use in school and have for several years down there. So we're looking to send it to a few other children's ministries around the world, and then some local groups to help students with preparation for school this next year. So hopefully we'll be able to get it out and get it, you know, it all put to good use.
But, oh, great. Well, we're glad that went well for you. Thanks for joining us for that quick update. That's Brent Ressler with Small World Connections, setting the world record for longest line of pencils laid out consecutively. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great day.